Thank you. Thank you very much, Ratnagosha, for such a warm welcome and introduction. And lovely to be here in your midst. Yeah, very nice to see Sangapala here too. Just Ratnagosha mentioned I've been at London Buddhist Centre for many years, but I also spent 7 years at the Dublin Buddhist Centre on the invitation of Sangapala. So it's very nice to see him. Yeah, so lovely to be back. Let's see what I'm going to say. Let me check the time. If I run out of things to say, but there might be time for some questions or there might not. It's hard to tell. So 7 years ago, I had the, well, great, but it turned out to be a great joy. I wasn't sure about it before it happened, but actually it was turned out to be a great joy to go to the first order convention that we held in India. I was a bit nervous. I'd never travelled so far before, but I was very glad I went. For some of you know this, but for those who don't know, we usually, in the past, we'd always held the order conventions in Norfolk. But then this year, we decided to have it in India. And one of the main reasons being in Norfolk, only a very few of the Indian order members could actually come. And so someone came up with a very good suggestion if we have it in India so that then there could be much more of a mixture. And it was an amazing thing. Some of you were there, I know. What we used to do is every morning we'd go at some unearthly hour, 5 o'clock in the morning or something. We'd go to Bodh Gaya, which is the holy shrine, and then a procession all dressed in pale blue, which is what the Indian order members wear for ceremonies. But we'd all wear that, Westerners as well. And we'd take our place at Bodh Gaya. I don't know how many of you have been, but it's kind of a bit mad, really, because, well, it is a holy shrine. But it's how to describe it? It's very, very big and very, very noisy, because what you've got is like lots of different groups of different Buddhist traditions coming together and doing puja mainly, like all through microphones and loudspeakers. So that's all going on. So you had all sorts of different groups, mostly recognisable because of their dress. So, you know, you had white-clad Burmese, you had maroon-clad Tibetans. And, well, then you had us. Most of us had these kind of light blue shirts, or the Indian women would have had saris on. And what you could notice was that people were really looking at us, wondering, well, who are they? Because what I realised now is we must have caught quite an unusual sort of spectacle, because, well, we were just such a mixture. So we were a mixture of Indians and Westerners, and we were a mixture of men and women. And I do remember one particularly memorable occasion. I can't remember the name of the Indian Dharmacharini, but it might be Jnana Shuri, one of our senior women order members, also a public preceptor Indian in India. She led the puja, so it might have been her, it might have been one of the other women order members. But now I realise that must have been quite a thing in India, that here you had you had this whole mixture, and you had a woman leading a puja, and you had an Indian woman leading a puja for this whole mixture of Westerners and men and women and so on. You could see people quite sort of taken by us and kind of thinking, well, who are these people? They're dressed the same, but actually, you know, they're such a mixture. And I was thinking the reason that could happen, was because of the vision of Bhante, was because of the vision of Bhante. So that's what I'm going to hopefully talk to you about tonight. What was that vision of Bhante when he established the order, and why is the fact that it's a unified order sort of singled out as one of the six particular emphases of Sri Ratna? I know that that's what you're doing for this series. This fact of being a unified order, and I'll say more about what that means, but that kind of little picture of us all at Budgar perhaps gives a flavour. And yeah, and what a sort of amazing vision that was of Bent is that probably we don't even fully realise. I probably don't fully realise it, and probably it's one of those things that the more you think about it, the more probably unfolds from it. So Bhante Sangharajita founded what is now the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, was then the Western Buddhist Order, nearly 50 years ago, on Sunday the 7th of April 1968. And on that day, 12 people became ordained. And that was a mixture of men and women. So right from the very first, it was a mixture of men and women. And in fact, I think I've got this fact right, because Damodin had told me, who's a very senior order member, that out of those 12, it was a woman who was ordained the very first. Because Bhante used to do it in order of seniority of biological age, and a woman was the oldest, presumably, so she was ordained first. So that's one of the first, when we talk about it being a unified order, one of the things we mean by that is that there was a completely equal ordination right from the very beginning, right from literally the first ordination for men and women. And it's kind of equal in two ways, two main ways, three ways. Well, the opportunity for ordination is equal for men and women. The actual ordination is equal. The sort of process is equivalent. It's sort of slightly different, but it's equivalent. So the ordination and the process to ordination is equal. And also within the order, men and women are equal. I don't know what quite the right word is. Try not to use the word status, but I can't think of another word. You know, there's equal, like the in the usual tradition, like women, ordained women would have more rules and all that kind of thing, and they'd be lower than the men. Anyway, they're not in Tri Ratna. It's equal. So once you are ordained, you're equal in. Well, there's nothing institutional that makes you not equal. I mean, you might not be equal. You know, there are men order members I look up to. There are women order members I look up to. So, you know, there'd be a natural hierarchy. There's nothing institutional that makes it unequal. So in this fact alone about it being equal ordination for men and women, and it had been unified in that way, it was quite a departure from the Eastern Buddhist tradition, where it wouldn't have been equal. It would have been more difficult for women to get ordained, and also once they were ordained, there would have been more rules and so on. And that was a radical step. It even made the papers, actually. A friend of mine, an order member, Satchadasa, his grandfather was also a Buddhist, and saved this newspaper cutting. I don't know if it was a national or local paper, but he's actually got this newspaper article that says first British Buddhist women ordained in Britain, and that was us. That was Tri Ratna or the WBO. So it was that was us. So this was a departure from the tradition. The other thing that makes a unified order and another real departure, and again very, very important thing in Bhante's well thinking and practice, was that it's not an exclusively monastic order. So this was some of you will know this. If you've read any of Bhante's writing, you'll know how important this was to him. That he created something entirely new. So what had been the case was, as we probably know, Bhante had lived in India for many years, was ordained in India himself, and kind of basically started to have very, very deep questioning of the whole monk-lay divide as he saw it. So what he would have seen was that while there were very many, obviously very good monks, he probably saw a lot more monks than nuns, although he would have seen nuns as well. He would have been more in contact with the monks and there'd have been more of them. But, you know, so many of them would have definitely been sincerely practicing and so on. It sounded like there was quite a lot that weren't. There was quite a lot that were more like just a bit onto a free meal ticket, you know, because they would have been supported by the laity, so-called laity. And by, on the other hand, you'd have these so-called lay people who were actually very, very sincerely practicing. They were, the message they were being given was that, you know, the best they could hope for was a good rebirth, and they could get that by serving the monks. Perhaps that's putting it a little bit kind of too crudely, but that was the kind of basic message. And, well, what Bhante would have seen was actually this isn't, you know, this isn't really true, actually. These so-called lay people are practicing, in many cases, more sincerely, more effectively even, than the monks, and maybe nuns as well, but certainly the monks. So he was very, when he set up our order, a very, very audacious thing, actually, a very bold thing to set up a whole new order, and I'll come back to that, I think, setting up an order. He was very, very keen that it would be, it wouldn't be exclusively monastic. People could choose that lifestyle if they wanted. It wouldn't be exclusively monastic or lay. It'd be something over and above that. It'd be an order where commitment was primary, and that everybody could make that commitment. So this was a very, very bold step. We probably take it for granted, you know, because we're kind of in it. We're in the order, in the movement, but very, very bold step. And Bhante himself said that he thought, when now looking back on it in his writing, he said he thought it was the biggest step yet taken by British Buddhism to have this unified order where you've got men and women ordained equally, and where you've got this order where commitment is primary. So it was a radical, in some ways it was a radical departure, but in another way it was completely traditional, because what Bhante believed he was doing, and what I certainly as an order member believe that Bhante was doing, was actually going more deeply back into the tradition, going back into, well, the principles taught by the Buddha. So I just want to say one or two more things about this equal ordination of men and women. The main thing I want to say, I hope this doesn't disappoint any of you, but the main thing I want to say is that although it was very, very radical, Bhante was absolutely not doing that for sort of socio-political reasons. He wasn't doing it to be, as a sort of equal opportunities thing. It absolutely wouldn't have been his, well, I know it wasn't because I've read in his writings, but even without reading it, you know, if you know anything about Bhante, you know that wouldn't be, that absolutely isn't the reason. That wasn't, it's something much, much deeper than that that's the reason. And what that deeper reason is, and I know you're going to be exploring this here over the weeks, perhaps I'm preempting that a bit, but it's impossible not to, because it's the fundamental thing, which is the deeper reason than anything that's sort of merely socio-political, goes right back to Bhante's ever-deepening understanding in the primacy of going for refuge to the Three Jewels. That's what it comes out of. It kind of quite simply comes out of that. And that's what, it's quite interesting to sort of to see, if you read Bhante's writing, to see how he worked that out ever more deeply, his own realisation that actually going for refuge to the Three Jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, is the basis for everything, that every single thing comes out of that, and that's the Well, that's the one. Well, that's the unifying thing, actually, isn't it? Actually, maybe that's just kind of trying to sense. That's the thing to say. You know, and Bhante himself is famous. They said, in a way, question everything, but accept that. Well, I mean, you can question that if you want, but in a sense, if you did question that, that would be questioning the whole sort of basis of our order and movement. So that's the fundamental unifying thing is going for refuge to the three jewels. Okay, so I'll sort of, in a way, there's many, many ways probably to talk about that, and it's great to hear you'll be exploring that over the next number of weeks. So I'll try and talk about it in one way. The way, really, to look at the whole of the Dharma life, what is it we're trying to do by leading the Dharma life, is that we're trying to break free of egoistic clinging. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to break free of that, not because that's bad or wrong, but because it's the source of all our suffering, according to the Buddha. It's not a moralistic thing, it's an existential thing, that we're trying to break free of egoistic clinging. We're trying to break free of that sort of tendency that brings everything back to me in the end. While we're still unenlightened, everything at some point will either quickly or slowly come back to what's in it for me while we're unenlightened. And one traditional way of talking about that, and again, this will be familiar to many of you, is talking in terms of what we call the 10 fetters. It's quite a good image, these fetters, because they're literally, well, fetters, something that binds you. So you can imagine we're sort of tied to this sense of me by like 10. I used to think of them in terms of chains, but I've more recently started thinking of them in terms of elastic. So by these 10 strands of elastic, the sort of image of them being elastic works quite well for me, because I think, you know, sometimes you can stretch the elastic quite far. Like sometimes you can say you've just been on retreat, or, you know, you've been doing a lot of meditation or something. You can stretch quite far into feeling very metaphor, very generous, very compassionate and so on. You know, so you can maybe go for quite a long time with that sense of what's in it for me quite attenuated. You know, you've stretched. But while the fetter's still there, it will at some point kind of boing back. You know, you'll get this. It'll snap back to what's in it for me. Sometimes it's very, very quick, isn't it? Embarrassingly. You know, you think you're so kind of wonderful and metaful and you've had this wonderful meditation, and then, like, the minute you come out of meditation, it does. Do you know that? It's sort of, you know, you're snapped right back to, well, how could, you know, why did that person close the door so unwisely? You know, why? And you're right back to, or I hope, you know, so-and-so, my preceptor, noticed how still I was sitting there, you know, and you're boing it right back to me, you know, they're the fetters. So you've got these 10 fetters, 10 elastics, as I more and more think of them. And so there's 10, and then those 10 are further divided into the first three and sort of all the rest. The first three are, we often emphasize those because it's said that on breaking the first three, then you become sort of irreversible. Your dharmic momentum's so strong that, you know, there's no falling back. You've still got the other 7 to break, but you're using that model where you've got this momentum. So the first three are particularly important. So the first three are fixed self-view and doubt, habitual doubt, and the third one, which is what I'm going to focus on, adherence to rites and rituals as ends in themselves. And Bhante has glossed these, very, very useful they actually, in a little lecture called The Taste of Freedom, as habit. So the sort of fixed self view he's glossed as habit. Doubt he's glossed as vagueness, which is quite good because it shows you that it is actually a willful thing. It's not the sort of healthy questioning doubt that we need. It's actually a willful vagueness. And then he's glossed this third one, the attachment to rites and rituals as ends in themselves, as superficiality. And I was thinking about this talk, I was actually reading something, which I'm going to read to you, that Bhante talked about this third fetter, and I thought, ah yes, this is exactly what Bhante was doing when he founded our order, and founded it in such a way that he did, with going for refuge at the centre of it. He was making sure that our order actually became a means of freedom, not actually, you know, one of these fetters or elastics or chains that actually, in the guise of freeing us, was actually binding us. And the bit that I was reading is from, you might know this, Know Your Mind. So I'm just going to tell you what he says in here under this fetter, because I think it's very, very illuminating about what he was thinking when he founded our order. So as you know, and as I've said, Bhante, he lived in India as a monk, as a bhikkhu, and then he returned to England, and this is what he says. He says, "I myself provoked an astonishing reaction when I started letting my hair grow," because he would have been in robes and had his head all shaved. When he came back, he kept the robes, but he let his hair grow. So it says, this caused a lot of disquiet, not just in Theravadan circles. Mahayanas and even Zen Buddhists all seemed to find it quite upsetting. And he said, it seemed that ethical formalism was already creeping into Buddhism in Britain, even though it had only been going for a few years. That's quite interesting in itself, because it shows that how quickly that does creep in, that formalism, which is really this fetter, that superficiality, that thinking about the rules, you know, in this case, like robes, long hair, not going together. Yeah, so it creeps in very, very quickly into, into one's own heart and then into our collective activity. So you've got to always be on the lookout for it. So he said, yes, so it seemed that ethical formalism was creeping into British Buddhism, although it had only been going for a few decades. He said, so I let my hair grow longer and longer. He said, after a lecture one evening, which I think would have been at the Buddhist Society, people came up to me and spoke to me about the length of my hair, which now amounted to a couple of inches. And one of them said, I don't know why you're growing your hair so long. It's really upsetting everybody. We don't know what it means. So he found that very, very, you know, so simply that's what he'd done. He'd let his hair go while wearing the robes. So then eventually, as we know, he stopped wearing the robes. I don't know how long, probably after a year or two. And he said that some people were quite pleased, but he didn't really think they were pleased for the right reason. He said, as with the issue of their hair, their approbation was not always for the right reasons. So some were pleased. He said, but there were others who were deeply upset, feeling that this was tantamount to giving up Buddhism. So that's interesting. He's let his hair grow, he stopped wearing robes, and people around him, you know, are upset, think, oh, you must have stopped being a Buddhist. So he says that the whole episode was something of an eye-opener for me. And when I set up the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, which of course is now our Tri Ratna community, he said he tried to discourage any creeping paralysis of the forms and institutions through which we practice and spread the Dharma. Interestingly, he immediately kind of caveats that, as he always does, because he immediately says, don't go to the other extreme. He says, you know, in communicating the Dharma, we should be responsible, not encourage mere self-expression. So on one hand, he's saying, don't stick to the rules, but on the other hand, he's saying, don't just, what he would call, be an individualist and rebel just for the sake of it. And he says that there is, there is a value in discipline. In the Dharma life, in any spiritual life, but then he goes back and says, however, a certain margin of creative variation is not only permissible but desirable. So that's very, very. That's what was behind him, establishing our movement and order. He wasn't going to stick to the old formality just for the sake of it. Just to tell you about this last paragraph in this little chapter, he said, the idea that we have to break away from religion and morality is ordinarily understood before we can make any progress on the path, he says, is a radical one even for Buddhists. But he says, it's quite literally what we have to do. Otherwise, we're wasting our time. So that's quite strong, isn't it? And so this is all underpinning, his thinking. Even if he didn't have it so fully worked out, this was his very strong intuition in founding our order. He wasn't just going to set up an order in the old way. Not just because he wanted to be different, because he saw that this is quite literally what you have to do. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. Probably worse than wasting it. Because you'd probably actually be better not having an order at all than one that was actually binding you more tightly. And then he says, this third fetter is really a fear about breaking the rules. He says, but why are we afraid of breaking the rules? He says, because we don't trust ourselves. We think, if I don't observe the rules, who knows what will happen? All hell may break loose. And he says, yes, perhaps it will. I think that's what Bhante was doing when he was setting up our order. He was letting all hell break loose, in a way. He was saying, we're going to do something that's completely different. We're going to take, as he said, the biggest step yet taken. So I think what to remember from this bit is that, actually, often religious groups, and you see that, you can see when people come along to our Buddhist centres, they're naturally wary. I mean, I'm the Mitra convener at the LBC. And people, you can see they're very drawn to it, but they're naturally wary, and I think quite rightly so, of what looks like a religious group, because I think religious groups themselves can often be places where we're expected to conform. And Bhante's trying to turn this on its head, and he's tried to set up our order in a way that turns this on its head. And then it's kind of up to us to make sure we don't go back into that conformity. I was just thinking, this is why, we've got to be free. That's what I'm saying. We've got to be free. If we're going to be part of an order, we've got to have the freedom to be creative. So this is what Bhante is most interested in, I think. He wants to create a situation where, in his terms, people can become true individuals, where people can be free to grow. That's the most important thing. That's why he had to completely move away from the tradition in all its forms. And the reason why Bhante's interested in this is because that's what the Buddha was interested in. The Buddha was interested, that isn't even quite the right word, interested, it sounds too weak, doesn't it? The Buddha was, the Buddha was driven to communicate was human potential And yeah, with human potential and how we can dedicate ourselves to that. And that's what Bhante's compelled to communicate. And that's why he established our order. And because it's on that basis, in a sense, the whole question of whether there should be equal ordination, say, for men and women, like, doesn't arise if you take it back there, because it's just human potential. So again, I hope it isn't disappointing to any of you who thought there was going to be some sort of political debate about all this, because it's easy to get into the whole politics of in this kind of discussion. But I think for Bhante, it just wouldn't arise, because he just went back to the principles. The principle is human potential. So he said, well, all human beings have got that potential, so ordination must be equal for all human beings, whether men or women, whatever the background or race or nationality or lifestyle, it's got to be equal. So whether somebody's living as a monk or nun, or whether they're, you know, living, bringing up a family, to Bhante it would have just been absolutely... there'd be no question that ordination would be equal for all those people, because it's based on that principle. I don't know whether to go on or see if there's any questions about this. Maybe I'll say just a little bit more. I think I've got some time left. But if you've got any questions, save them up. If there's no time in this, you can ask me them in the tea break. I was interested as well, although I don't think this was totally my brief, but I did think that within this whole question of a unified order, so in a way I've sort of focused in this first part of the talk on the fact it's unified, but I also wanted to focus on, well, it is an order. But, and again, that's something that Bhante did, I don't know if he exactly asked himself, but he made it conscious and made it clear that it was an order he was setting up. It wasn't, for example, a society. In Britain at the time, I think I don't know if there was any other Buddhist order. There was certainly the Buddhist Society 50 years ago. It's still going. So you could have had another society. I mean, Bhante could have said, okay, there's this Buddhist society over there. I'll kind of set up my Buddhist society over here. But he was very, very clear that he wasn't setting up a society, that actually what he was establishing was, well, first of all, a movement, then 1 year later was an order, which then is the sort of nucleus of the movement. So why ordination? So Bhante wanted to set up an order because he wanted... because of Sangha, really, he wanted to create a community of people who were committed, and committed as Buddhists, committed to, freeing themselves from this ego clinging. So he wanted, that was what he wanted to be the heart of what he established. He wasn't interested in something that was just an organization, however well run. He wanted Sangha, he wanted commitment. So that was why Bhante set up an order rather than a society or any other sort of group. But I think it's interesting to ask myself as an order member, well, why did I join an order from my side of it? I think it's quite interesting why you join an order, because I think in a funny way it's sort of, you can answer it, and I will try to, but it's also mysterious. often people kind of find themselves asking to join the order almost in spite of themselves. I see that. Again, when my work as Mitra convener, you see people going, and both as Mitras and order members, they kind of think, I'm not going to ask. And then they ask, you know. It's like some, and you can't really, you can't totally explain it. And it's interesting with Bantu himself. As a very young man, his heartfelt wish was to become ordained. He just kind of, it's an intuition that probably goes beyond the rational. And he was terribly disappointed a few times when he couldn't be ordained when he was in India because of various reasons. You know, and then when he actually was ordained, he really describes it as a very, very momentous time in his life. And I imagine, you know, certainly for myself and those of us who are ordained, it's a momentous time in our life. And it's hard to... It's just hard to put it into words. It's hard to really explain why that's so and what exactly compelled us to want to join the order. So I think it's mysterious. I thought I'd try and open it out a little bit, briefly. And when I was thinking about this, what suddenly came into my mind was the three traditional offerings that we make in all our ceremonies, Mitra ceremonies, ordination ceremonies, they're on all our Buddhist shrines. Well, actually, one of them isn't the incense. maybe people, but often on our Buddhist shrines, which is a flower and the candle and the incense. So I think that when I think about my ordination these days, it's something one understands more as one goes along. So I think it's got, I think of it in about three levels at the moment. I'm sure that will change as the years go on. I think there's the individual benefit to commitment, the individual benefit to dedicating your life to something that goes beyond yourself. I heard a talk by someone the other day, and they said how they phrased it was being receptive to a truth that's higher than your own truth. And I thought, oh, I really like that. When you commit yourself, you're saying there's something higher than my truth and I'm being receptive to it. And the offering that I thought sort of symbolised this for me was the offering of the flower. So traditionally how we talk about the flower offering is that the flower is representing, well, beauty and impermanence, and how they go hand in hand. But also, of course, the flower, well, it is something that grows. It's a symbol for growth, isn't it, a flower? So when we commit, we grow. But we also grow in a way we could never have predicted. A bit like that little seed of the iris could never have guessed, in a sense, that it was ever going to become an iris. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? There's something completely new emerges that you could never have imagined. People sometimes talk about the acorn could never have imagined it's going to be an oak tree, you know. You can't imagine, if you think of growth in that way, you just think, oh, I'm going to become a bigger and bigger acorn. It's not that you just become a bigger and bigger you. You actually grow into something that's completely unpredictable. So I think that's the first level of ordination. And then, of course, you realise that as an order you can do so much more to benefit the world. I thought of this, I particularly became aware of this from something Bantu himself said. He visited the LBC about 8 years ago now, and Maitreya Bandu, one of the teachers there, was saying to him, Bantu, are we doing the right thing being here at the LBC, teaching and so on, or do you think we'd be better off going up a mountain and meditating? And what I remember is Bantu just looked really, really surprised at the question. He said, but this is where the people are. And Maitreya Bandu actually repeated the question. He said, but Bantu, are we really doing the right thing? And Bantu just said, but this is where the people are. And I just suddenly thought, oh yes, I felt like I got a bit maybe a glimpse of what Bhante's perspective might have been. I thought, if you're Bhante, what you must be concerned about is that the Dharma as teaching, the Dharma as truth obviously is universal and infinite, but the Dharma as teaching will eventually fade away. So if you're Bhante, you must be concerned about how can we keep that alive as long as possible before it fades away. What do? You create an order. And then that made sense of what I've heard people saying before, is Bhante's creation of the order is the fulfillment of his bodhisattva vow to help all beings, or the an expression of his bodhisattva. I thought, oh, you create an order. And so then I suddenly understood being in the order in a new way. Oh, it's kind of with a glimpse, possibly, of the perspective of a much infinite, the greater mind than mine. I felt I got a glimpse into the mind of Bhante, that the order is a means of helping the Dharma to stay alive in the world for as long as possible. So I thought, this was like the incense offering, you know, so just as the stick of incense, you know, its perfume spreads far and wide, and actually you don't really know where it goes. In a way, as being part of the order, you don't really know what effect it has. So part of the movement and order, whether we're a friend or a mitra or an order member, you don't really know the effect of that, but it will be having an effect. Again, that's you can start to see as well that thing I was saying about Bhante not creating a society. That wouldn't really have the same offering quality as this. And then there's the more mysterious level. That's the order as kind of an enactment of the way things are, in that our sort of illusion of ourselves as a separate self is just an illusion, and actually we have to die to that and be reborn with the realization of interconnectedness. I think the ordination ceremony itself is probably the strongest ceremony we've got that ritually enacts that spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, but of course we're enacting that in all different ways. And so that made me think about the offering of the candle. So the candle is obviously light, but I think there's something very, very mysterious about a flame, isn't there? That if we had another candle, you light a candle from the flame, it's then a light. The original flame isn't diminished, but a new flame is lit. And that's kind of, it's both mysterious. It's kind of a simple thing, isn't it? Lighting a candle that we probably do nearly every day, but it's got this, I think it's got this very kind of deep meaning to it, that one flame can light another. Bhante's talked about when we've asked him what our lineage is, one of the things he said, he gave four different ways in which our lineage is expressed, but the most important out of all of these four is the lineage of inspiration. And I think that's what Bhante was trying to do when he created an order rather than a society. And that's what we do when we join the order, if that is what we do, is we help to keep alive as a living flame this lineage of inspiration. Our flame is lit from the shrine, literally, in the ordination ceremony and the mitra ceremony. Even when we come forward to make an offering, our flame is lit from the shrine. But the shrine light is still there, but something new is ignited. So that's what I quite enjoyed thinking about that, actually, thinking about, well, why an order and why have I joined the order? And these three very simple offerings that we possibly don't even think about when we see them on the shrine, when we offer them to the shrine, they've got very, very sort of resonant meaning. So Okay, so in summary, in his own practice of continually exploring within his own mind and own thinking, this our primacy of going for refuge above all, absolutely over and above all, Bhante's created an order that's about dedicating yourself, oneself, to human potential. He's created a movement that's about dedicating oneself to human potential. And automatically, that means that that's equal for all human beings, whether one is a man or a woman, whatever one's lifestyle, whatever one's background, that just naturally flows out of that. It goes without question. Although it's a radical thing in the world, it's a radical thing for those onlooking, but from the inside, it's just completely natural. It completely couldn't be otherwise. It literally couldn't be otherwise if you've got going for refuge as primary. If it was otherwise, then going for refuge wouldn't be primary. Something else would be primary. Then something like rites and rituals would be primary. Something like socio-political concerns would be primary. But that isn't the case in our movement order. Going for refuge is primary. So it goes above and beyond those distinctions of whether one's a man or a woman, whether one's living as a monk or a lay person. It goes above and beyond. And as with everything, this is both a gift and a challenge, a tremendous gift, tremendous gift to us, a tremendous gift to me that I can be ordained as a woman. Tremendous gift, but also it's a tremendous challenge as well, because then you've got to actually live up to it. Then you've actually got to do it. And I mean, Bhante, I tell you, he expects so much from us. Whether we're an order member, especially if we're an order member, but also if we're a mitra, all practitioners, he expects so much from us. I was just thinking of two things in regard to this. One was, I thought it might be relevant to talk about this here. An old Windhorse trading seminar from about, I think, 20 years ago, or maybe 30. Very, very good seminar. It's really worth reading. And again, the people working in Windhorse at the time, it's called Windhorse Trading at the time, some of you might even have been there, maybe, asked Bhante the same question as Maitreya Bender, really. Are we doing the right thing with our lives? They're saying, look, we've committed our whole lives to this, but are we doing the right thing running this retail wholesale business, or should we be off meditating? And, so Bhante, goes through, he says, well, are you practicing mindfulness? And they say, yes. And he says, and are you practicing, do you have to be energetic? So first of all, he goes through the five spiritual faculties, right? But they're still not convinced. And he says, but Bhante, can we really realize insight by doing this? And he very, very strongly argues the case for, well, work as practice. And what he said, but one of the things he says, well, he says, when you're working, you really care about what you're doing. And he said, for example, if you negotiate a huge deal and it falls through at the last minute, he says, that is an opportunity for insight, because that is your opportunity to reflect. If you're feeling disappointed, you can reflect, well, who is this, or where is this me that's feeling disappointed, for example? So anyway, he argues this case for the insight reflection that comes out of, well, deep disappointment in this case. And the order members, all order members, they say, oh, but Bhante, you'd have to be reflecting on the Dharma all the time for that to work. And he just turns around and says, well, you're order members, aren't you? And then it's recorded in the seminar, nervous laughter. So, but for him, he just thinks, well, you're order members. Like, what else would you be thinking? It's almost like, what else would you be thinking about apart from the Dharma all the time, So he expects no, he really does expect no less. And I was just, you know, looking at, I see you've got that lovely, lovely phrase from Bhante out in your reception room where you've got the picture of Bhante and the quote from Bhante saying that he believes that any human being can be friends with any other human being. But like, Bhante really means that. It's not just rhetoric. Like, that is what he expects of each and every one of us. So that's what I mean by he's given us this great gift of he's created an order, he's created a movement that's unified, that's not making a distinction. But also he's kind of not letting us get away with anything. Whatever our lifestyle, he's saying, well, you can be a full-time Buddhist. You can be like totally committed, and you know, and he expects no less of than that from us. For him, it would just be a second nature. So, I think I shall wind up there. I think we, as usual, I've probably talked longer than I thought, so probably not time for questions here. But yeah, I will be around over the tea break if you, yeah, it'd be lovely if any of you had any points or questions. But thank you very much.